Well, you've pretty much already gotten the sermon this morning, so I'll just make a few comments on the songs, and then we'll go home for the day, and you guys can eat lunch early. We are looking at, in James, the sixth lesson of James, on six of probably 99. I started to name the lessons, and I wanted to keep a two-digit format, so that way there'll be no more than 99 lessons. But in James, we're looking at the double-minded man and how ultimately, you know, James describes, as I said last week, the unbeliever as double-minded, unstable in all his ways. And fortunately, when he's talking about that, he's not talking about unbelievers in the sense of non-saved. He's talking about you and I when we cease to believe or cease to act in faith on an ongoing basis and how that affects us in our daily walk. And it's an ugly thing, and it produces ugliness in our life. What is double-mindedness, though? Well, it's facing one way and then facing the other way. So it is having two allegiances that we are divided against, or divided by. Now, when you, every one of these songs, I know Trey picks these songs out in advance. He even sends the list out. So I could have just, you know, looked at the list and then actually built a sermon around it, but I rarely ever look at the list of songs. I didn't this week, which you may not believe. I was sitting back then and I was thinking, I got to make a few comments about these songs. And so I went back and grabbed a bulletin, and I'm looking through it, and I see, did you change the service a little bit ad hoc, or are these the actual songs that we sang, the ones that are listed right here? Because I couldn't remember singing 361, but I must have been thinking about what I was going to say and not actually singing. All right, so anyhow, with the exception of 361, because I can't remember singing it, every one of these songs is talking about emphasizing the greatness of God, and its effect on us. Now, why do we sing about the greatness of God? Obviously, He deserves it. Obviously, we should be doing that because He is the King Supreme and reigns and high from high, and He is all sovereign. He deserves every bit of glory that we could ever give Him for an eternity of glory. But there is an effect that comes from that as well, and I think, you know, even just singing this one, 232, "Lead me to Calvary." We sing about the King of my life, and I crown Thee now, and Thine shall be the glory, and then in the fourth verse, "May I be willing, Lord, to bear daily my cross for Thee." And back on 276, I'm not going to talk about each one of these, but just brief, this is just amazing how this works out and the timing of the Holy Spirit. But "Rejoice, the Lord is King, your Lord and King adore. Rejoice, give thanks." And then he says in verse 3, "His kingdom cannot fail. The ruler, He rules over earth and heaven. The keys of death and hell are to our Jesus given." I'm going to use the pit analogy again this week about the life that we get ourselves in. We find ourselves in some kind of a vicious cycle sometimes where we feel like we can't get out of the repetitious life that we find ourselves in, the non-victorious life, whatever that may be. And as Beth Moore describes it, the pit. Get me out of that pit, or get out of that pit, the book that Colleen and I just finished reading. But really it comes down to one thing. If our focus is on Him and the supremacy of Him and the majesty of Him and His greatness, then we aren't double-minded. We cease to be double-minded. We cease to have two affections. We cease to have things that divide our attention. And it gets us right out of the pit. It's like an automatic release. So it's really kind of very simple, and so I'm just going to make it more complicated because I have to eat up 45 minutes. But really, it comes down to that. So let's talk about it a little bit, though. Now, before we get there, All right, before we get there, we're going to do a quick review. Now, you're going to help me with the review on this, all right, because what happens is I review, and then you just go to sleep during the review, so I don't want that to happen. In James 1, 2 through 8, what I want you to do is help me come up with a five-word summary for these verses, okay, for each one of them, or the verse sections, a group that I put together. My brothers and sisters, consider nothing but joy when you fall into all sorts of trials. Now remember everything that we've talked about in there regarding each one of these things, because you know that the testing of your faith produces endurance. Five words or less. Give me a summary. This is your opportunity. You'll have another one later, by the way. What? Joy? What about joy? What? Okay, consider your trials joy. Consider your trials joy. That's four, that's good. All right, what else can we say? Anything else? Put it in the joy bucket. Sorry, that's six. Put it in joy bucket. Now remember, there's a couple key things here. Consider. Put your mind on. You have to do this. It doesn't come automatically. It requires a conscious effort to do this thing. All sorts of trials, no matter what they are, there's no mitigation against that. You can't say, well, not this one. But every kind of trial, we've got to put it into that joy bucket. And there's also a result. So we got to get considering trials, joy, for the results. What?
Testing your faith produces endurance.
Testing your faith produces endurance. All right? That's good, but we don't have the joy part in there. Consider trials joy for endurance. Okay, that's the best one I've heard so far. That's just because I'm married to her, though. Consider trials joy for endurance. All right, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. All right, we can work on that. That's pretty good, though. All right, let's go to the next one. And let endurance have its perfect effect. Now, let, remember, doesn't come automatically. You got to make sure that this happens, because while the testing produces perseverance or endurance, you have to pass the test in order for this to be true. How do you pass the test? Well, passing the test means ultimately allowing this effect to take place by handling these trials properly. So let it have its perfect effect. When that endurance comes, it comes by the test, it will have a perfect effect if you let it, so that you will be perfect and complete and not deficient in anything. Five words or less. Hopefully this doesn't have the opposite effect of what I was hoping for.
The effect of endurance is perfection and completion.
What? Six words. All right, we'll just take out you. Good. But if anyone is deficient in wisdom, remember now, he says, you're going to be perfect and complete, not lacking in anything. Oh, but by the way, if you have a lack of wisdom, so if you haven't gotten there yet, if you want to get through this trial, if you want to pass the test, then you're going to need some wisdom. So if you don't have the wisdom that you need to get through that trial, then what do you do? Ask God. This is a God who gives to all generously and without reprimand. And by the way, keep that in the back of your mind as we talk about the rest of this lesson, because, again, the key to getting out of the pit, the key to the victory in the Christian life is a focus on Him, a conscious focus on Him. And He is that kind of God who gives to all generously and without reprimand, and it will be given to Him. So, deficient in wisdom, ask God, you get it. That's not my summary. What's the summary? Five words.
Deficient in wisdom,
We got the asking part, but what about the receiving? How about that? All right, that was good. Thank you. What? You want to come up here and type for me? But he must ask in faith. Now, here's the thing. God wants to give it. All you got to do is ask. But... make sure you ask without doubting, because, or doubting is that word for going back and forth. It's a picture of the next phrase. It's that picture of the wave. Without doubting, for the one who doubts is like the wave of the sea blown and tossed about by the wind. Now, just for summary's sake, you might want to include something about the wave or not, but that's not necessarily the key. That's just the picture to help us get a picture for what's going on. But the key is about this wavering. And not receive, and the next phrase is what happens as a result.
Don't waver asking faith.
Don't waver
ask
in faith. Good, I liked it. Okay. Very good. And finally, for that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord, since he is a double-minded individual, unstable in all his ways. So if you ask with wavering, then you don't get anything. The result of your double-mindedness. Can be, yeah. Yeah, it's hyphenated. That counts.
Receive nothing when double-minded.
Okay, receive nothing when double-minded. All right. Is there how about this? All right? Okay, that way we get both of it in there. All right, good. So what we have, consider the trials, joy, for their effects of endurance. Now, let this endurance perfect and complete you. God will give wisdom when asked. Don't waver when you ask in faith, and otherwise receive nothing when you are double-minded and unstable. By the way, sense is really not in there, but we'll talk about that in just a minute when we get to the part you really love best, the diagramming. Now, I'm actually not even going to read this today for time's sake, but this is the following passage, and we'll be getting to this next week. I know your favorite part is the diagramming, but I want to highlight this again for you today because there were some things that honestly I didn't even see until I diagrammed it myself, and I want you to recognize the importance of this. Again, you don't have to diagram things to get out of the Bible. But it's an effective tool for me, and I hope it becomes an effective tool for you because I like it. A couple of things I just want to highlight here. But, he, subject, must ask, verb. And doubting here is raised above that, which indicates that it's a participle. It's one of those ing words. It's must ask, doubting, nothing. So the participle is an adverbial. All right, now I know this is highly technical, but just bear with me because it really is significant. So if it's an adverbial participle, what word is it modifying? Modifying ask, the verb. It's not modifying he. It's modifying the verb ask. So look at this. But he must ask, and when you do it, one of those adverbial things in a participle, it's either like while or by or since or because. You can put one of those helper words in there to kind of help you understand what he's saying. It's impossible to know except by the context which one of those words is supposed to go in there. But he must ask, we could say, let's try a couple of them. He must ask while doubting nothing. Or he must ask by doubting nothing. Either one of those kind of works. And you must do that in faith. There's the preposition. While doubting, as you are doubting, it modifies ask and not faith. So in other words, the key here is not that we never doubt, because we're going to doubt. And that doesn't disqualify you from the Christian life. But when you ask of God, that's when it's important that you not be doubting. Because in that instance, it's asking while not doubting. It is not to say that you never doubt, but rather when asking, you should ask without doubting, which is an important distinction. For, we go into a new phrase here, a clause, for the one who doubts, and here it is again, and you don't see this necessarily in the English, but this is the same word, and again, it's a participle. It's the same ing. So, in this case, it's actually adjectival because it's tied to the word one, but the way he's designed this phrase here is really ultimately going back to the asking again. So we have two for clauses. I'm sorry, getting ahead of myself. So doubts is the second participle, this time adjectival modifying the one, but because it's actually the same word, it refers us back to the asking and the time frame thereof. That is, in other words, while doubting, or the one while doubting should not do this thing. Again, kind of emphasizing this point of, you know, you're going to doubt from time to time because you are not perfect yet, but when you ask of God, make sure that you don't doubt. And then we get a... there are two for clauses in this thing that are in parallel. And so two things happen, and I'm out of sync here. Okay, so I'll jump back. There's this for the one who doubts, and I'll talk about the rest of that in just a second. And then there's this other for. And they're both the same word in the Greek. It's gar, which is the word for for. In other words, it's not just English translation didn't just add it for the benefit of our reading. It's actually in there. And when you see that, you see, oh, this is clearly a parallel clause. These are both subordinate to the asking. And you ask for the one who doubts this thing has happened. It's like this, like the wave of the sea being tossed and driven by the wind. And for, in the asking, for this man or that man should not suppose that he will receive anything. So there are two things that comes about as a result, or the need for doubting nothing. One is, what happens if you do doubt something? And the other one is, what happens if you do doubt something as well? So, the one who doubts is like this wave of the sea, and the one who doubts will not receive anything from the Lord. All right? Now, back up for just a second, and I'll talk about the details of this part. The one who doubts, this one, is like a wave of the sea. And then there are two parallel participle phrases again. And again, I'm sorry for the technical nature of this, but there is some importance we can see from this. Both have been parallel, so we see that there's this being tossed that comes about from like a wave, and also being driven by the wind. One is, but they're both very just all over the place, and they both relate back to this doubting, to this double-minded nature of having two different emphasis and always testing, engaging what it is that we should be doing. And it's just like a wind that comes along. And interestingly enough, though, that being driven by the wind is actually one word. So in English, you would normally put by the wind underneath that as part of the prepositional phrase. But being driven by the wind is one Greek word that's in there. All right, so for the man must... He's all over the place, if you doubt, and also, he's not going to receive anything from the Lord. And then the word that's down here, the man, that man, is actually in the Greek, and it's a pronoun that points clearly back to the he, which is important. Because there are two words here that are given to us. One is the man is anthropos, the first man. The man should not suppose. Anthropos is a kind of a generic word. It's a word we get anthropology from. And it's used, it's oftentimes used, it's the word, I'm leaving my junk around, sorry about that. It's the word that's oftentimes used for generic man, woman, mankind, or whatever. And it emphasizes a lot the physical nature of man. And then the second one, though, is a man, which is a different word altogether. It's on air. And rarely translated as meaning man or woman, but it certainly can be. And so I think it's appropriate to think, obviously appropriately to think about this for both both genders. All of us are included in this problem. But he put the pronoun in here in the that so that we're sure we don't miss something. It's not that no one received anything from the Lord, right? But the one who asks, when you're asking, and you're not going to get from the Lord if you ask with the doubting. And he is not in the Greek. This was added for our benefit, but this is an apposition. Thus the arrow that draw the two things. You know, an apposition is a word where you have just kind of a repeat of the same thing, or emphasis, or giving us further clarification. Acts as an adjective. So the man is how? How do you describe this man? He is double-minded. He is unstable. And in what ways? This is really important. He's unstable in all his ways. So I say, Lord, I'm asking you for wisdom. I'm not sure if he's going to give me wisdom or not. I mean, he certainly can give me wisdom. He's got the ability to give me wisdom. He's sovereign and he's omnipotent and he knows everything and he knows I really need wisdom, but I'm not sure he's going to give me wisdom because maybe he doesn't want to give me wisdom. Maybe he feels like I got too much wisdom. You know, that could be the problem. And so I go back to this testing and back and forth, and so what happens? I don't get wisdom. Probably takes away all the wisdom I already had. But it doesn't just end there. It affects everything that I'm doing. And it makes me unstable in all my processes and all the things that I'm... That it affects everything, my whole life. And it makes me unstable in all my ways. You could see this in individuals' lives, by the way. And you see a person and you think, wow, that guy's really with it. He's someone I want to emulate. If there's a Christian I want to be like, it's that person right there. And then something goes along and sure enough... We all mess up at some point in time or another, and we can think of a few individuals that we've seen, and what happened to them? They, at some point in time, something happened and they became unstable in all their ways. They don't have to be there forever, and they probably won't be. We all get into a pit from time to time. And all stands out to impact the force of which ways are unstable. Not just some, not just a few, but all. Double-minded highlights a division of interest between choosing to serve the Lord or not, including a willingness to put all items into our joy bucket. Serving the Lord, yes. How many of you want to serve the Lord? Now, when the trial comes, how many of you want to put that into the joy bucket? Well, you know you're supposed to, but when the trial comes, how many of you want to put it into the joy bucket? You can say that in advance, right? But it's much more difficult to do that. That's all part of the deal. You know, he didn't just come along in verse 2 and say, put that into the joy bucket, my words, but put that into, you know, and I have to explain this because Connie says, why is everyone talking about the joy bucket? She wasn't here that week, and so for your benefits as well, the idea is this. You got two buckets in life. You got the joy bucket and the not joy bucket. And whenever trials come, you got to say, which bucket is this going to go into? And he says, James 1, 2, consider all trials of various kinds, whatever they are, joy. So if I got two buckets, joy and not joy, I don't have a choice. If I'm going to act in obedience, I'm going to put it into the joy bucket. So there you go, joy bucket. Now, so... That's part of serving the Lord, and that's a part of not being double-minded, is to have the choice, verse 2, we set our minds to choose these things, to be willing to do this, letting the trials produce perseverance in our lives, and so we become then steadfast, complete, and lacking nothing. And here, asking for wisdom is a means toward that specific end. In this passage, ask for wisdom so that you can accomplish this thing, and ultimately put things into the joy bucket. And while asking without faith will result in receiving nothing from the Lord, in general sense, asking for wisdom so that we can pass the test, will not just result in a failure of the test, but it results in absolute failure and even results absolutely in absolute failure. So asking without faith or without doubting is not just resulting in failure, not just resulting in absolute failure, but absolutely resulting in absolute failure. It's like Bev used to say, Price still does. Not now, right now. Right? And these are some of those absolutes that you can say exist in the Bible. There are two things we can do here specifically in this one statement that will result in not receiving anything from the Lord. Two things. One is very obvious. Asking without faith or with wavering and you will receive nothing from the Lord. The other one is implied. What is it? Two things you can do that will result in not receiving this from the Lord. What?
Not asking.
Who said that? Very good. Not asking. So if you can ask without faith, or you can just not ask, and you got the same results, don't you? Because he wants to give us wisdom, and when you feel like you don't need to ask the Lord for wisdom, that's another problem in itself entirely, isn't it? Evidently, I must suffer from that problem. Now, so back to the victorious Christian life. We know that we begin with hope, tremendous hope in the Bible. All kind of promises God has given us. We have all things that happen to the good of those who love Him all things will happen to the good of those who love Him and those who are called according to His purpose. Romans 8:28. So I say yes. Trial comes. Now we got to experience this in our family just the other day. One of my children got upset, and someone didn't move when they were asked to move, and my child stood up and hit their head on a door or something, got really mad and kicked the other person. And so I was trying to explain to this child, there are some things that you can do here. And one of them is, when you get upset, you can say, "That really makes me mad. I'm going to punch a hole in the wall. I'm going to kick someone. I'm going to, you know," and then what happens? Well, then I got a hole in the wall. My hand hurts because I've now punched a hole in the wall. I may have hurt someone else. Things have not gotten any better. Or I can say, well, what does God say? Or what are we supposed to do when God does something good for us? When anyone does something good for us, we're supposed to say thank you. And so if the Bible says, consider it all joy, therefore if a trial comes and I am considering it joy, that sounds like a good thing. So when the trial comes, I may not like hitting my head, but obviously when something good happens to me, I should say, thank you. So then what happens? I feel so much better about hitting my head. Now my head still hurts, but my hand doesn't hurt on top of it. I don't have a hole in the wall. I don't have to get a spanking as a result of kicking someone. And so there is a way to accomplish this. And part of this requires a couple things. One, we ask, as he says in James, ask for hope. Ask for wisdom, rather. We must ask with faith. When we get to James 4, we saw that we have to ask with the right intentions, not just for our own purposes. We know that God will provide. We know the kind of God He is. We know that He says He will provide, so we don't even have to guess about that. But then we have to fully subject ourselves to this mechanism. But in all of that, we have to do three things, the ABCs. You know, Beth has three C's. I think I've got it much better. Of course, she makes more money than I do writing books. But she'll consult me one of these days, I'm sure. Now, first thing we have to do is acknowledge, believe, and then continue in that. There's a couple things in acknowledging. I didn't really highlight this too much last week. I'm going to spend a few more minutes about this. One is acknowledging where we are. Now, I'm convinced that you don't have to know the specific cause of your being in a pit in order to get out of it. You know, the Bible doesn't say, understand the psychology behind the reason you're in a pit. Doesn't say you've got to sit back and you've got to go see someone. He's got to tell you, well, because you had this childhood and you had this happen to you and all that, you're in this pit and you really need to. Doesn't say that. So I know you don't have to know those things. Sometimes it's helpful to understand the realities of your pit, though, so that you don't fall into the same pit again. In other words, you may be in a pit and may be causing you to produce sin. And maybe that you're doing these kind of sinful habits, but maybe the sin is just the result of you being in a pit for some other reason. And if you can understand that reason, that's good. The Bible says that we should be aware of the devil's tricks. He's like a roaring lion laying about to deceive us. And so we should know about those things, what's going to get us into a pit if we can. But if you can't, it doesn't really matter. He says just get out of the pit. So first thing we have to do is recognize and acknowledge the fact that we are there. We have sin. We're doing this. And again, it can be either an overt sin or a covert sin. It can be either a sin of commission where I say, here's a list of God says I shouldn't be doing this and this and this, and I'm doing one of those things. That might be why I'm in a pit. Or it might be a sin of omission where he says, you know, really you should be acting, you should be living a life like this. Or maybe you just live by faith and I'm just living by comfort instead. And so whatever it is, there's some reason that we're in a pit. We have to acknowledge that fact that we're not where we need to be. But we also, and this is really ultimately what I'm getting at in acknowledging, is that God is able and wants to get us out of that pit. We acknowledge who He is, what He does, and what He says. That God alone is God, and that you are not God. And so we acknowledge who He is, we acknowledge our problem, we acknowledge that who God is, and we acknowledge the fact that we are not able to do it ourselves. And so then we believe that God will get you out. One says that God can do it, two says God will do it, one also says God can and I can't, two says God can and I will let Him. But that doesn't mean I just sit back and do nothing. You know, there's a popular phrase in Christianity that says, let go, let God. Right? I'm not opposed to that phrase, by the way. If I had invented that phrase, I would probably use it. But because someone else invented it, I can criticize it, and that's okay. It's a perfectly fine phrase as long as you keep it in its context. And if you like to use that phrase, I have no problem with that. But it's really not entirely accurate. I mean, you really don't just let God and let go and just kind of sit back and say, yeah, God's going to do it for me. He's going to get me out of this pit and everything's going to be fine. He says, you know, I'm going to put some stairs in there for you. I'm going to give you some work to do. I'm going to give you some things to look at, some ways specifically to trust me. I'm going to give you some helping hands. You're going to have to rely on me. So it's not really entirely true that we just let go. Sometimes, though, we do need to let go of certain things in order to let God do things in our lives. I certainly understand that. And then three, we have to continue in this because the trials are going to continue on, and we have to be willing to continue in that and let these things have their perfect work in us as He has already told us. Now, going back to the first point of acknowledging God and His supremacy and who He is. God is all these things and many more. I like this listing of God's attributes because I can remember it because it's I lie thus on the floor. So it's kind of a picture of me. See the letters over there on the left-hand side. I know floor doesn't have three O's in it. You'll forgive me for that. And then we've got the names of God. And all this points back to who He is and what He is in our lives. And I want to talk just briefly about some of these points and then kind of open up for some opportunity for us to think through how this helps us in our daily lives. So it's a good thing to know that God's immutable. It's a good thing to know that God is love. He's infinite, eternal, and true, and holy, and just, and sovereign, and all that. But how does that help me get out of my pit? So that's what I want to look at. So God's immutable. Now, I'm not going to go into a whole lesson on exactly just what immutable means. Let's read a few verses about it, and then I'll talk about it. The preeminent one of Israel does not go back on his word or change his mind, or he is not a human being who changes his mind. I know a few people like that. I used to think Colleen was more like that, but I come to find out that I'm actually far more like that. She gets some kind of cereal, and I'm like, that's the cereal I always want. Never want to get any other kind of cereal. The next time she gets that cereal, I'm like, why'd you get that cereal? I don't like that cereal. And somewhere in there it changed, and it's true, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. And the crazy thing about it is I'm like so adamant about this, I want this, and the next time she does differently, which was exactly what I told her. And then I'm like, no, I don't like it that way anymore. So I am a human being, and I change my mind, and I'm certainly not immutable. Since I, the Lord, do not go back on my promises, you, sons of Jacob, have not perished. Think about that for a second. There were certainly opportunity for them to perish, certainly reason for them to perish. Certainly God could have done it, and no one would have thought twice about it. You know, at the time they would have perished in the wilderness, no one had written the Bible yet, so he could have done it, and no one would have even known today. Right? I mean, seriously. But that's not who he is. And so he makes a promise, and he sticks with it. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday and today and even next week. And then all generous giving and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or the slightest in a change, because God is who he is. Now, I'm not going to go through each one of these attributes in this way. But let's talk about immutability for a second. Immutability, in a nutshell, means God's character, nature, promises remain steady and constant, always trustworthy, never faltering. What God says will happen, and you can bet the farm on it. The nature of the company that I work for being what it is, I get to be in a lot of business meetings that I've never really been in before. So we meet with investors. We meet with people that are potentially interested in our technology. And I get to sit in on some of those meetings, have conversations with people that I probably would have never met before. Some of them have a few dollars. I met one guy, and a few of us went to dinner with him and kind of told his story. This guy had heard about a company that was about to be bought up by another company, a bigger company. Kind of got wind of this, a little rumor. And so he told me, yeah, when I found out about that, I backed up the truck. I put everything I had into buying stock for that company. And sure enough, they were bought out. And he made a couple $100 million on that deal. Now, that's a few more dollars than I have. That's kind of neat. But when he backed up that truck and put everything he had into that, it was taking a little bit of a risk. That's what investors do. Fortunately, the company did sell, and things happened just the way he wanted them to. But there's some educated guesswork that goes into all that. Now, even if investing were pure science and formulas, and there's some science and there's some formulas that go about it, but ultimately there's a little bit of guesswork in there, Sam. There's a little bit of trust, a little bit of faith every now and then, a little bit of hope. and wisdom probably says you don't usually back up the truck and put everything into it, right? But since the beginning of time, when people were trading clamshells or fur skins or even apples off of a tree of knowledge of good and fruit, of good and evil, there has been no guaranteed investment. Never has there been one that absolutely guaranteed, except for one, right? An investment in the God who is the God of all creation. The only absolute guarantee of investment that you have. But here's the question for today. Come on, computer. How does the immutability of God help us? How does it help us out of a pit? How does it help us to live the victorious Christian life? How does it keep us from being a double-minded man? How? What? We know he's always going to be there. All right? So we know he's always going to be there. Yeah, I'm in my pit, and I know you're always going to be there. I'm still in my pit. How does knowing he's always going to be there help me?
He doesn't go back on his word, and the promises in his word are true today as well.
All right. God promised Abraham, I will give you descendants like the sand of the sea, like the stars of the heavens. And that's one of his promises, and he did not go back on it. How's that help me out of the pit? Kept, but how does that promise to Abraham help me out of the pit? What? You can rely on him for what? Look, every day I go to work, every day that I work, I rarely actually go to work anymore. So, but every day that I work, I am very reliable at what I do. I mean, you know, you can tell up here when I'm preaching that I mean, when I come in here, I'm so organized and I got all my stuff all ready to go. I am absolutely reliable. You know that about me. So now you know I'm reliable and I teach you a sound lesson like you've never heard before. Easy now. We're in church. And now tomorrow when you go to work, how's that going to help you? I've said everything that was true and I've been a very reliable person. How does that help you? Well, it doesn't unless you know that I have some kind of a relationship with you and that I've told you things that are going to relate to you, right? Now, I mean, everything you've said is true, and you're already thinking that internally, but I just want to make that clear and conscious for us and concise and concrete and correct and clear, clarified, that it doesn't matter if God's immutable. It doesn't matter if God is always going to do what he says unless he says something that affects you and I. And he has. A whole lot, right? He's given us his whole word. Let's take an example. We've seen this one before somewhere. I think I read it says something like, consider it nothing but joy when you fall into all sorts of trials because you know that the testing of your faith produces endurance. So, how does the immutability of God help me with, how does this verse and the immutability of God relate together for me getting out of a pit? So the trial comes, and I say, not this trial. This trial does not belong in my joy bucket. I could think of several buckets it should go into, but not my joy bucket. And then you say, well, wait a minute. But who said that it should go in my joy bucket? God said it. What kind of God is he? Well, he's an immutable God. Well, does God know my trials, though? Oh, yeah, because he's omniscient. But is God really able to help me put my trials into my joy bucket? Yeah, because God's omnipresent and omnipotent. Well, yeah, but does God really want me to put this trial into my joy bucket? Yeah, because God is holy and he is sovereign. Yeah, but does God really care about me putting this into my joy bucket? Yes, because God loves me. Yeah, but you see, I got one. But God's bound to other principles. God has stated things in his word that's going to, if I put this into my joy bucket, somehow it's going to be contrary to other things he has said. Well, everything that God says, he's orchestrated in such a way that God is not even bound to be able to produce truth from any of his statements. He is free. In other words, God can make this statement and he can make this statement that to you and I, we can't see how those two can go together at all. And yet, God is not in any way kept back from being able to produce truth from both of those. He is true and he is free. There's all kind of, and I spoke too long, so I didn't get to what I wanted to get to here. Here's what I'll give this as an exercise for you for the following week. Here's what I was going to do. Let's talk about these qualities very quickly. Immutability is no change. Love, seeking the best for the object loved without expecting anything in return. Infinite, no bounds or limits in time or space, transcendence, loftiness over creation, and yet imminence and nearness to man at the same time. Eternity is a little different than infinity. Eternity speaks more maybe of time and his or lack thereof and his constraints within. Truth, absolute agreement to that which is represented. God not only is true, but God is truth. As it says in John 3:33. Holiness, it is to be set apart. It is the broad gap between the created and the creator. It is set apart from sin. And although holy, God is still joyful. He is the joy of the Lord is spoken of in Nehemiah 8 in the context of holiness. So while we may sometimes think of holiness and joyfulness being as opposite extremes, they're not. God is one. God is sovereign. He is absolute and complete control of all things. God is not dependent upon His creatures for anything, so He is free. God's living, not dead. Nietzsche said, God is dead. And God came out with a bumper sticker later that said, Nietzsche is dead. Because he has died. He's been dead for a while. Omniscient, knows all things, all-powerful, everywhere. Nothing is impossible with God. And God is righteous, which means, which relates somehow to His holiness, but it also means that He will deal justly with us and to His Word. So my question for you, we were going to break up into groups of three or less, and you were going to kind of work with the people sitting next to you. In other words, or if you were sitting next to no one, you were going to work on this on your own. And you were going to take 5 minutes, and I'm telling you this ahead of time because this is what we're going to do next week. But you're going to pick one of these traits, and you were going to think about and come up with some very specific ways in which, concrete and tangible ways in which this attribute that you picked would help you out of a pit, help you to live a victorious Christian life, and then I was just going to ask you to share that with me. All right? That'll be a good exercise for next week. And we'll kind of start off with that, so I'll make sure that we get to it. But in the meantime, here's your challenge for the week. It's the same one as last week because it flashed off the screen so fast most of you didn't get to see it. Read through James, these passages talking about the asking of God, and then ask Him for wisdom. But remember, don't do it with wavering or you won't get it. And then you'll be unstable in all your ways and you'll have to blame me for it. And then over the next week, not necessarily related to these passages, but just look for in your own life and maybe jot down some opportunities for ways to live by faith. Because He says, how are we to live our lives? By faith. And if you're not looking for ways to actively, proactively believe, trust on Him, His character, His quality, His attributes, His deity, His personhood, then we're probably not actually doing that. All right? Let's close in a word of prayer. Lord, thank You for who You are. You are immutable and true and holy and united and sovereign and living and infinite and eternal, holy, righteous, omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent. You are perfect. You are the Creator of the world. And nothing happens that You don't know about. You've given us many promises, and You want us to have a victorious life, and You've given us the keys to it, trusting You, asking for wisdom. And so we ask, Lord, that You would help us to see our faults, help us to recognize who You are, and look for ways to live in light of Your greatness. And I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.